Joseph at the Pyramids. The Nile rolled its slow course along between flat, reedy banks, where many a palm tree still stood half-submerged and mirrored its trunk in the subsiding flood. There were plots of land in the blessing zone between desert and desert, where the corn and barley were already green. On others, cattle and sheep were being driven by white-aproned brown bearers across the level land, that they might tread the seed into the soft, moist earth. Vultures and white falcons peered and hovered under a clearing, sunny sky. They swooped down toward villages half-hidden by towering date palms with crowns of fan-shaped leaves. There were many such settlements along the irrigation canals. Their dung-roofed dwellings had walls made out of Nile mud and buttressed like pylons, and everything bore the stamp of the characteristic, all-pervading spirit of the land of Egypt. Its forms and its gods conditioned the picture of men and things. Heretofore, and in his own country, Joseph had only seen it in single manifestations, as, for instance, some characteristic building. Here, it confronted him in all its typicality and in great and small. At the village landing places, naked children were playing among farmyard fowl. Shelters made of poles and withies stood along the bank, and people, returning from their necessary occasions, came poling along the canal and landed from their high-backed osier barks. The river, dotted with sails, divided the land into two parts from north to south. But everywhere the fertilizing watercourses ran east and west, and made it into islands like oases of fan-shaped green. You walked on the road, as on a causeway, among ditches, reservoirs, and groves. Thus the Ishmaelites passed on southwards, amid all the people of the land, riding on asses, driving loaded wagons drawn by oxen and donkeys, or going on foot, apron-wearers carrying ducks and fish on yokes to market. A lean, reddish, flat-bellied folk, square-shouldered, inoffensive in bearing, ready to laugh. They had thin-boned faces with projecting jaws, little noses broad at the end, and childish cheeks. A rush blossom in their mouths, behind one ear, or stuck in the much-washed apron, which had a diagonal hem and was higher back than front. Their hair fell smooth over the brow, and was cut off straight under the earlobes. Joseph liked these wayfarers. Considering what they were, people of Sheol and the land of the dead, they were pleasant to look at, and they laughed as they shouted greetings to the Shabarite dromedary riders, for anything foreign to them was a joke. Joseph tried his tongue on their speech by himself, and trained himself by listening, that he might soon be able to talk readily with them in their own idiom. The land of Egypt was narrow at this point, the strip of fertility small. To the east, on their left, the arid Arabian ranges ran close by, matched by the sand hills of Libya on the west, their deathly desolation masked in purple loveliness as the sun sank behind them. But at the edge of the desert, in front of this chain and near the greening fields, the travelers saw straight ahead of them a symmetrical and very singular elevation, composed of triangular surfaces, whose huge plains met in sharp corners and ran together to a point at the top. These were mountains not created by nature, but made by the hand of man. They were the world-famous erections, the old man pointed them out to Joseph as they went, the monuments of Khufu, Khephren, and other kings of the early time, built through decades by the sweat of hundreds of thousands of slaves coughing under the lash, built out of granite blocks weighing millions of tons, which they dug in the Arabian quarries and dragged to the river, ferried over, and, groaning, sledged to the border of Libya, where they hoisted them with some kind of incredible lifting apparatus and piled them into pointed mountains. Men fell and died, their tongues hanging out with their superhuman effort on the blazing desert, all in order that Khufu, the king and god, might lie far beneath them, shut off by a tiny chamber from the perpetual weight of millions of tons of heavy stone, a little twig of mimosa on his heart. It was no work for human beings that the children of Kempt had there performed, and yet it was the work of the same little folk who trotted and pulled along the causeways. the work of their bleeding hands, lean muscles, and panting lungs, won from the human, if surpassing the human, because Khufu was a god-king, the son of the sun. But the sun which struck down and consumed the builders might be satisfied with the superhuman human achievement, Ra Hotep, the satisfied sun. For in their abstract form, they represented him. They were his pictographic symbols. These great piles of death and resurrection stood there, sun monument and sun tomb at once. And their vast triangular surfaces, polished and glittering from base to apex, lay piously adjusted to the four quarters of the heavens. Joseph looked up wide-eyed at these three-dimensional tomb mountains, heaped up by slave labor in the Egyptian house of bondage so misprized by Jacob. As he looked, he listened to the old man, who expended himself in tales of King Khufu. Even today, sinister tales of that superhuman master builder were on the lips of the people. These 1,000 years and more, the folk of Kempt had preserved a grudge against the memory of that evil-doer who had got from them the impossible, for that he had been a bad and self-seeking god and closed all the temples that no one should steal time from him with sacrifices. And he had kept all the people harnessed in toil for the building of his marvelous tomb, and for 30 years had not granted even one little hour for their own life. 10 years, that is, had they to drag and chisel, and on top of that, build for 2×10, expending every ounce of strength they had and more besides. For reckoning all their strength together, it would not have been quite enough to build the pyramid. The necessary remainder had come to them from the divinity of King Khufu. But they had not been glad. The building had cost great treasures, and when the treasure of that majestic godhead had been exhausted, he exposed his own daughter in the palace, and gave of her body to every man who paid the price. By such means he replenished his treasury. So went the legends, the old man said. It is quite possible that they were for the most part fairy tales and falsehoods, which were told these thousands of years after Khufu's death. But so much was clear that the people were even now more terrified than grateful to him for wringing out of them their utmost and more, and insisting on the impossible. As our travelers came nearer, the peaks stood up separate in the sand, and they saw that the surfaces of the triangles were damaged. Their polished planes had begun to crumble. Desolation reigned between the giant tombs, as each by itself, and all too massive for time to have done more than nibble at their surfaces, they stood there on the shelving rubble and sand of the desert plain. They alone had come off victorious in the frightful struggle with time, which had long since destroyed and buried the splendors with which piety had once filled the spaces between their mammoth forms. Temples of the dead had once leaned against their sides, where services in honor of those dead in the sun had been set up forever. Covered passages thick with pictures had once led thence, and broad-based gates on the eastern side near the fertile zone had once formed the entrance to the closed passages which led into the enchanted kingdom of immortality. All of this Joseph in his day saw no more, and did not even know that not seeing was actually a no more seeing, a beholding of destruction. He came on them early, of course, by comparison with his relation to us, but from another point of view, he was late and green indeed. His gaze encountered this great rubbish heap of death, this bald survival of a mathematic of giants, as one's foot will stub against a pile of rubble. Astonishment and awe did move him, of course, at sight of these triangular domes, but the frightful endurance which made them, forsaken of their time, stand here, survivals into God's present day, gave them, among their other aspects, something awesome and accursed in his eyes. He thought of the tower. Then there was that riddle in the headcloth, Hor Imachet, the great sphinx, which lay somewhere hereabouts, residual, flat on the sands which were drifted over so as almost to cover it. Pharaoh's predecessor, Thutmose IV, had rescued it out of them, obedient to the promised dream which he dreamed when he took his midday nap. That was not so long ago, but the sand was already mounting again about the enormous creature, which had lain there so long that no man could say when and how it had come out of the rock. Drifts of sand slanted up to its breast and hid one of the paws. The other paw, still free, was the size of three houses. At the breast of this mountain, the son of the king, like a doll compared to the immense god-beast, had lain asleep while his servants at some distance guarded his hunting wagon. And high above the mannikin rose the inscrutable head with the stiff neckcloth, the immortal brow, the eroded nose which lent it a somewhat roguish air. The rocky vault of its upper lip, the wide mouth which seemed to be shaping a sort of calm and primitive and sensual smile. The clear, wide-open, intelligent eyes, intoxicated from deep draughts of time, gazed eastwards as they had ever done. And thus it lay there now, the immemorial chimera, in a present whose distance and difference from times of yore were doubtless negligible in its eyes, and gazed steadfastly, sensually, unchangeably, away eastwards above the heads of Joseph and his owners. An inscribed tablet, more than a man's height, leaned against its breast, and the Menians read it with refreshment and strengthening of the heart. For this recent stone afforded a firm basis of time. It was like a narrow platform which gave a foothold above the abyss. It was the commemorative tablet which Pharaoh Thutmose had erected here in memory of his dream and the moving of the sand. The old man read the text and the pronouncement to his people, how the prince, lying in the shadow of the monster, was overcome by sleep at the hour when the sun was at its height, and saw in his dream the majesty of this glorious god, his father, Harmachis Kepere Atum Re, who spoke fatherly to him and called him his dear son. "It is already a long time in years," he said, "that my countenance is directed upon thee, and my heart the same. I will give thee, Thutmose, the royal sovereignty. The crowns of the two lands shalt thou wear upon the throne of Geb, and to thee shall the earth, after its length and breadth, belong, with all that the radiant eye of the All-Lord shineth upon. The treasure of Egypt and the great tribute of the people shall be thine. But meanwhile, the sands of the desert where I lie weigh heavy upon me, all worthy of adoration as I stand. My justified wish groweth out of this weight. I doubt not that thou wilt accede to it as soon as thou canst, for I know thou art my son and my deliverer, but I will be with thee." When Thutmose awoke, so the story went, he still knew the words of the god, and kept them in mind until the hour of his elevation. And in that very hour his command went forth that they should at once remove the sand which rested heavy on Harmachis, the great sphinx, at Mempi in the desert. Thus the tale. And Joseph, who listened as the old man his master read it, took care to add not even one little word, for he heeded the old man's warning to hold his tongue in this land of Egypt, and wished to show that in case of need one could conceal even such thoughts as he had. But in secret he was vexed on Jacob's account at this dream of the promise, and in his vexation found it arid and meagre. Pharaoh, so he thought, made altogether too much of his tablet. What, after all, had he been promised? Nothing more than that which had been his destiny from birth, that at a certain hour he would become king and reign over the two lands. This definite prospect the god had confirmed to him, in case, that is, Pharaoh rescued his image from the sands that threatened it. And here one saw the folly of making to oneself an image. The image fell into danger from the sand, and the god into such a pass as to implore, "Save me, my son," and to enter into a bond wherein he promised in exchange for a petty benefaction something that would most likely happen anyhow. Joseph found that offensive. It had been a different and higher bond that God the Lord had concluded with the fathers, likewise out of need, yet mutual need. that they should save each other out of the sands of the desert, and become holy the one in the other. In any case, the king's son had become king at his hour, but the desert sand had already encroached again upon the image to a considerable extent. For such passing relief, probably only a redundant return gift was in place, thought Joseph. He expressed his thought to Kedemah, the old man's son, when they were alone, and Kedemah was amazed at such a critical spirit. But let Joseph carp as he would, and mock out of respect to Jacob, yet the sight of the Sphinx made on him in one way or another more impression than all he had hitherto seen in the land of Egypt. It set his young blood in an unrest, against which mockery did not avail, and which did not let him sleep. Night had fallen while they lingered by these great things of the desert, and so they set up their tents that they might sleep and go on to Mempi in the morning. But Joseph, who had already lain down in the hut with Kedemah, his bedfellow, strolled out once more under the stars. He heard in the distance jackals howling as he approached the giant idol, to look at it quite by himself, without witnesses, in the brightness of the night, and question its uncanny vastness. For uncanny it was, that monster of old time, in its regal rock headdress, and uncanny not only for its size or even for the darkness of its origins. How did the riddle run? Ah, it ran not at all. It lay there, or crouched, consisting but in the silence, that rapt drunken silence, in which the monster gazed out with its wide, wild eyes above the questioning and questioned. And its want of nose had an effect as when a man sets his cap crooked over one ear. Yes, if this had been a riddle like the good old man's about his neighbor Dagantakala's plot of land, then, however, the numbers were hidden and concealed. One might have shifted the unknown quantity hither and thither, and weighed the proportions so as not only to find the answer, but to enjoy the game and be arrogant at one's own skill. But this riddle was nothing but silence, and its was the arrogance, to judge from its nose. And if it had a human head, it was nothing for such as he, let him be ever so clear-headed. To begin with, what sex was it, male or female? The people called it Hore in the Mountain of Light, and took it for an image of the Sun Lord, as Thutmose had done not long before. But that was a modern interpretation. It had not always obtained, and even if it were the Sun Lord who manifested himself in the recumbent figure, that proved nothing as to its sex. As it lay there, one could not tell. Suppose it got up. Would it then have majestic, dangling testicles like Merwer at On? Or would it reveal itself as female, as a lion virgin? There was no answer. For if at some time or other it had produced itself forth out of the rock, it had been as an artist makes a lying picture, or actually not makes but represents it, so that what was not visible was not there, and that 100 masons come with hammer and chisel to question the monster of its sex, there would be no answer still. It was a sphinx. In other words, a mystery and a riddle, and certainly a savage one, with lion's paws, thirsting after young blood, dangerous to the child of God, and a snare to the descendants of the promise. Alas for the tablet of the king's son! At this rocky breast, between the claws of the dragon woman, one dreamed no promise dreams, or at least very meager ones came to pass. It had nothing to do with promise. Wide-eyed and cruel, with time gnawn nose, fixed in vacant immobility, it gazed across at its river, and its menacing riddle was not of such a kind. It endured drunkenly on into the future, but that future was wild and dead, for that it was mere endurance and false eternity, bare of expectancy.